Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Weekdays, this is a Friday, so it's our last broadcast day of the week, and your last opportunity of the week to call in and talk with me and our audience about the things on your mind, especially related to the Bible, Christianity, your own walk and journey in the realm of spiritual things, your areas of disagreement with the host. Feel free to call about those things. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And that was sort of a Paul Harvey thing. There wasn't that long pause. Well, you learn from the great broadcasters when you're a broadcaster and you're an amateur like myself. You have to listen to the great ones and copy them. So the number is 800-438-5090. And we'll talk to Ken from Arlington, Washington, first of all. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Good morning, Mr. Well, actually, good afternoon, Mr. Gregg. How are you doing today?
That it is. Hello. I'm fine. Thank you.
Good. I got, two questions. One's a personal one. Are you the same Steve Gregg that used to run the Great Commission down in Southern Oregon?
Same one, yeah.
Same one. Wow. Wow, it is a small world after all, isn't it?
Yeah, the radio makes it a little bigger, but it is small.
It is small. Well, the question I had, it's actually pertaining to, it's kind of a little bit off the wall. The verse where Jesus says to the Pharisees and Sadducees, he says, there is no marriage or giving a marriage in heaven. You know, they just presented him with the, basically the law of discourse of who's wife will this brothers be after she's gone through all seven brothers. He said there is no marriage or given marriage or like the angels in heaven. And my question is, I just read a commentary that actually said that the phrase marriage and given to marriage may not mean that there's not marriage in heaven. It may just mean that there's not multiple marriages in heaven. And they actually referred to, I guess, a couple other articles of Hebrew literature where, like in the time of Noah, they were marrying and giving in marriage. Meaning that they actually had repetitive marriages. You know, they would marry somebody for a while, then divorce, and marrying somebody in divorce, et cetera, et cetera. And that technically in heaven it could be that you would actually be married to a woman. There could be, how do you want to call it, there would still be kids in heaven. And this guy was not a Mormon, which is the first thing I thought he was, but he went ahead to list other verses where it says the barren will actually have more children, and in the increase of God's kingdom there will be no end. So I'm curious if you could comment on that, if you could.
Okay, well, the one about the barren having more children than the married wife in Isaiah 54 is not talking about heaven at all. It's talking about the fact that God is going to bring forth more children into his family through the Gentiles who had previously always been barren in that respect. Then he would bring forth for himself from the Jewish people who were his married wife. Paul quotes that verse in Galatians chapter 4 and makes clear that that's the point of that verse. The fact that it says in Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6 or 7 that of the increase of his kingdom there shall be no end, I don't think that the increase there is through necessarily natural birth. I believe that it's talking about expansion into new realms and conquering new areas. But the question about the meaning of Jesus' statement, first of all, he doesn't say anything about heaven. He talks about the resurrection.
Right.
The Sadducees were asking the question because they didn't believe in the phenomenon of resurrection. And they thought that their test question would prove that Jesus and everybody else who believed in the resurrection were ridiculous in doing so, because they pointed out that the law of Moses required a woman whose husband had died childless, required her to marry his brother and have children with him. And they brought up a hypothetical case. I believe it was hypothetical. I mean, they presented it as if it was an actual case of a woman who married a man, and this man was one of seven brothers, and every one of these brothers died childless after marrying her, and the law required, of course, that she marry each of them serially because each died childless. And so they saw in this an absurdity in reconciling this with the resurrection, because here we have seven husbands which were required by the law of Moses to marry her, And yet in the resurrection, they could hardly imagine the woman having all seven of these husbands as her husband there. And so they asked, whose husband shall she be? Now, it seems to me that Jesus answered to them, which was, he began by saying, you err because you don't know the scriptures or the power of God. And I think their error was that they didn't believe in the resurrection, and they thought that this particular case would show that the resurrection is a crazy doctrine, because it would require that all these people get resurrected, and these seven men would all be, you know, having the same wife then, because in their lifetime they'd had her as wife. I believe that his answer, I've never been real happy with his answer, and I think a lot of people are not, when he said there is no marrying or given in marriage in the resurrection. It only makes sense if he is saying she won't be anyone's wife. In other words, it's not just saying that there won't be new marriages or multiple marriages in the resurrection, but it's saying there won't be marriage at all. And otherwise, he hasn't really answered their question, because they asked whose wife will she be in the resurrection. If he was just saying, well, there won't be multiple marriages in the resurrection, so she'll just be that would imply she'll be no one's wife, or else she'll be the wife of one of them. But he didn't answer their question. They said, whose wife will she be? And he doesn't answer it. I think it's only if he's saying there's not marriage at all in the resurrection, that is, people will not be married in the resurrection, only then does it really give a definitive answer to their question. Because if he's just saying, well, people won't be getting married in the resurrection, well, that doesn't answer their question about whose wife will she be. They got married in this life. The question is, in the next life, whose wife will she be? So for him to say, well, in the resurrection, people won't get married, wouldn't even come close to addressing the question. I mean, he'd be making a pronouncement about some other subject. Likewise, if he's saying there won't be multiple marriages, like if he's saying all seven will not have her in the resurrection, if that's what he's saying, well, that doesn't answer their question either. They presumed that to be true. They assumed that not all seven would have her, and therefore they asked which one will. So it seems like if his words mean anything other than there will be no marriage in the resurrection, then his answer is not even relevant to their question, which doesn't seem to me like it'd be, I don't think it would silence them as it did.
Yeah, it was confusing, because, see, I was always given that interpretation, always took that interpretation myself. But then when the guy actually was saying that there was actual, the meaning, and I don't know what Hebrew literature he got it from, he just said there was writings, several other writings in the Hebrew literature, where the term in that day was kind of slang for marriage and given in marriage, actually meant a proclivity to marry somebody and get divorced, basically have multiple serial monogamy, if you want to call it that. And that's what really was confusing, because I have never read or come across anything that has ever alluded to that before.
Yeah. Well, I can see how the words Jesus used could be interpreted that way. They could be interpreted actually more than one way. But what I'm saying is, in the context, for him to make that particular statement would be like for him to ignore their question altogether and make a statement about the resurrection that nobody had asked about and is not relevant to the conversation. See, you have to look at the question they're asking and see that his answer is intended to show their ignorance. Well, you know, I mean, the only way that, like I said, if he's simply saying there will not be as there now is, the tendency for people to dump one wife and pick up another one, well, okay, fine. But what's that got to do with anything that they've asked about?
Yeah, like I say, the article was well written. It seemed to be, it just raised questions. And the more I thought about it, the more questions it raised, of course. And
well, I've never run into that particular argument, but I have run into people who've said, well, Jesus is only saying that there won't be new marriages contracted in the resurrection, because he said there won't be marrying and giving in marriage in the resurrection. So it sounds like he's saying that, you know, there just won't be any new marriages. And so some people who are currently happily married took some comfort in the thought, well, maybe that means that although there won't be new marriages in the resurrection, I can still have my husband or I can still have my wife because we got married here and in this life. But on the other hand, it's equally discouraging to people who either are unhappily married or they're married to a non-Christian who won't be with them in the resurrection, or people who are single and wish they were married and thought, great, now I get to die and go into a situation where marriage is not even an option. I think the truth of the matter is that if marriage from this life continued into the resurrection, but no new marriages happened in the resurrection, that would make some people happy, the people who are happily married. It would make almost everybody else unhappy. But my thought is that we have no idea what our desires or values or cravings will be in the resurrected state, the glorified bodies we will have. And therefore, sitting here today, me as a single guy, not altogether happy about being single, but a circumstance that was put upon me against my wishes, that, you know, if I died today and I say, okay, well, I'll never be married in the resurrection either, the idea of living eternally without a partner, well, I mean, that in my present state of mind, that doesn't sound all that attractive. But if that's the way it's going to be, then I have to assume that God, who cares more about my happiness and fulfillment even than I do, and knows what will bring that, must know that in the resurrection we will have a totally different mindset about such things, and that marriage will not be one of the things that matters to us.
Well, I do. I actually did read another commentary by R.C. Sproul, where he basically said that he believed that in the resurrection, and he was not the one that came up with this article, by the way. He basically said in the resurrection, he says, it doesn't mean you won't be able to do things with your present wife that you have today. It's just that you will share that level of intimacy with everybody that is in heaven. And technically, you won't need the, in other words, you will have that kind of relationship with everybody who's there. Not a deep sexual intimacy, but a deep relationship intimacy with just about everybody that's there. Therefore, in that regard, marriage would not be necessary from that standpoint.
And that's very probably true. I mean, marriage, the only reason that you would wish to be married in the next life is, well, there might be two or three reasons. One is if you wanted to have children, but I don't know that there's going to be need for more children to be born there. There's plenty of millions of people that are going to be there who've lived and died already in this life. One would be because you want to have sex, but the thing is that we don't really know that we will really want to have sex in the state we'll be in at that time. It's just like a little kid. You know, if they heard that there's not going to be tricycles in heaven, they might say, oh, gosh, I don't want to go there then. But, of course, once you outgrow your tricycle, you realize, well, I don't care if there's tricycles in heaven or not. I don't want one. And it may be that in the resurrection, you know, sex will be just as attractive to us as tricycles are to an adult. You know, I don't really think we're going to want to have sex there necessarily, because I have a feeling that the pleasure that God created in sex is only a type and a shadow of something else that's much greater that will probably inherit. And I think it's just like when a kid gets a two-wheeler instead of a tricycle, he doesn't miss the tricycle because the two-wheeler is
right.
Even more exciting.
Yeah, when he eventually graduates to a Harley, I mean, God, where else can he go to, right?
That's right. That's right. I guess after that, next thing he needs is a space shuttle.
Yeah, or something like that. Well, no, that was my question. Like I say, the more I read it, the more it baffled me. Like I say, the increase of God's kingdom, which I've heard in several different ways, and I've heard it in stuff. It kind of said, well, this doesn't make sense. And like I say, I read the article a couple times. The guy emphatically stated he was not a Mormon. I kept thinking, well, he must be a Mormon to be trying to put this in there. But
No, I mean, I could see people reading that verse that way. Like I said, I just don't think it'd be a relevant answer to the question they asked. By the way, Ken, I've got other calls to take, but what was your familiarity with the Great Commission School?
Well, you probably don't remember me too much, but I'm actually the guy that put the fluorescent lights up above in front of your worship thing. It was actually in the process of putting mercury vapor in the back end of the gym.
Wow. You're talking about in Bandon.
Yes.
Wow. See, I was at the Great Commission School longer in McMinnville. We moved from Bandon to, we were 6 years in Bandon, then we were 10 years in McMinnville. So you're going way back.
Way back.
Yeah. I sure wish I could tell you I remember you, but that's a long time ago.
Well, you preached at Earl Bissett's church.
Yep.
I was working for the city at the time. Actually, you did a little bit of premarital counseling with you and your wife, I think. You just had a child, if I'm not too certain. I have to say it's 25 years ago, so
Yeah. Give
me. When you get over 50, your memory kind of goes. But,
you're telling me.
I remember a man that had a mustache. I remember that kind of bouncy hair.
Well, that is kind of true. Yeah.
So just to let you know that I do remember that. And that's why when I heard the name, I said, "Gal, I got to take a day off and give him a call just to find out. My curiosity is killing me."
And now you're up in Washington. Well, great. I'm glad you called.
Well, you have a good day, and God bless you, sir.
Thank you, Ken. God bless you.
Take care now.
Bye now. All right, we'll talk next to Frank, calling from Henderson, Nevada. And we have a line open for you also. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can reach me here at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Frank, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm going to have to take this off the air, and it's kind of involved, but let's try it. Okay, yeah. I guess you've heard of good old Bart Ehrman, right?
Yes, I have.
Okay, I got some questions because I've been reading a lot of his teachings lately, and he really has a lot to say. Boy, I'll tell you. Let's see, a couple of things that I wanted to ask is, he says, like, the book of Daniel, for instance, was written after the fact that the prophecies in that book were written after they were fulfilled. That's number one. And he says that, like, Isaiah 53, Psalms 22 was written about Israel, not about Jesus. Right? That's two. That's two. And I guess that'll be enough to take off the air. So could you address those questions about, you know, Daniel being written after the fact and the prophecies of Isaiah and the Psalms not being about Jesus?
Yeah, be glad to.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
Okay, Frank, thanks. Bye now. Well, you know, Bart can say that. He can say that Daniel was written after the time that the prophecies were fulfilled, and in doing so, he's not being very original. Because that's what people have said about Daniel for hundreds of years who didn't believe in the Bible. Unfortunately for them, a lot of evidence turned up that didn't help out their theories at all. See, Daniel professes to be written by mostly by Daniel himself. There's a chapter or two that seems to be written by Nebuchadnezzar, but most of the book is written by Daniel himself. And he speaks in the first person, "I, Daniel, saw this and that." Now, Daniel lived in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. We're told that very specifically. And he lived longer than Nebuchadnezzar. He lived into the reigns of Belshazzar and even into the reigns of the Persian, early Persians, you know, Darius and Cyrus. So that period of time is essentially the late 6th century B.C. That is he lived almost all the way through the 6th century B.C. That's 500 and something B.C. Now, the prophecies that he uttered, no one believes they were fulfilled by that time, because he prophesied things like the Alexander the Great's conquest of Persia. Well, that didn't happen until the 4th century B.C., 2 centuries after Daniel's time. And if you go further, even after after Alexander's death, in chapter 11 of Daniel, we have prophecies about Antiochus Epiphanes, which was like 168 B.C. So we're talking 2nd century B.C. Now, Daniel lived in the 6th century B.C., but indisputably, some of his prophecies were not fulfilled until the 4th and even the 2nd century B.C. Now, almost everyone recognizes that, even the liberals. Even Bart Ehrman, I think, would agree that Daniel 11 is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, and that Daniel chapter 8 talks about Alexander the Great. Bart Ehrman would agree with that, but he doesn't believe in the supernatural. He's a liberal, and the liberals have all taken this approach for hundreds of years, basically, that since there is no supernatural, it's impossible that Daniel could have written so accurate about these things before they happened. So they decide that he wrote it after the fact. Now, their reason for believing that is not because there's solid proof that he wrote it after the fact, but because they have a naturalistic presupposition. They cannot allow a supernatural phenomenon. And predictive prophecy is a supernatural phenomenon. So Ehrman is simply very unoriginal in this claim. It's been claimed for centuries by skeptics that Daniel was written during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century B.C., in other words, about 400 years after it was really written. Now, do we have any evidence one way or the other about it? Well, plenty, actually. I mean, there's two different authors over the years have written books called Daniel in the Critic's Den. And one of them is Josh McDowell, wrote a book by that name. And I forget who wrote the other one. But But there's been lots of books written cataloging the actual historical evidence that has to do with Daniel and what has been discovered especially in the last century. I'll just bring up one thing in particular because there's other things to cover and other people to talk to. But for example, until about 1853, about 150, 160 years ago, until 1853, the critics said that the book of Daniel was historically inaccurate about the identity of the last king of Babylon. Now, Daniel chapter 5 very clearly makes the last king of Babylon a man named Belshazzar. Belshazzar is said to be the king of Babylon at the time when the Persians conquered it in Daniel chapter 5. Well, the name Belshazzar was unknown from any historical records, from any inscriptions, from any archaeological evidence. There was no evidence outside of Daniel chapter 5 anywhere in the whole world that there was ever a man named Belshazzar who lived. And therefore, the critics thought, well, Daniel's apparently mistaken about this. It can't be confirmed outside. And worse yet, there were other historians like Herodotus, the Greek historian, who wrote 400 years before Christ. And Herodotus said that the last king in Babylon was a man named Nabonidus, not Belshazzar. And so we had a conflict. We have Daniel chapter 5 saying that the last king in Babylon was named Belshazzar, and Herodotus, who wrote in the 5th century B.C., saying that the last king was Nabonidus. Now, of course, if there's a conflict between one historian and another, and one of them wrote in the Bible and the other didn't, then the one in the Bible is the one who's held in skepticism. So the critics said, look there, the Bible is disproved. Daniel said it was Belshazzar. Herodotus said it was Nabonidus, and therefore the Bible's wrong. Well, I guess they had the luxury of thinking that for a while until further discoveries were made. And in 1853, an inscription was discovered at Ur, a Babylonian city, and it was an inscription by Nabonidus. Now, Nabonidus, he's the guy that was the last king of Babylon, according to Herodotus, right? And Nabonidus, in this inscription, said, it was a prayer to a Babylonian god. He says, may reverence for you always dwell in my firstborn favorite son, Belshazzar. Now, this inscription was like a bombshell in terms of understanding whether Daniel was accurate or not, because outside of Daniel 5, there was not one shred of evidence anywhere in the world that a man named Belshazzar even lived. And now we have an inscription by Nabonidus saying, may reverence for thee dwell in the heart of Belshazzar, my firstborn favorite son. And so this inscription confirmed the fact that there was a man named Belshazzar, that he was the firstborn son of this other guy, Nabonidus. Now, Herodotus said that Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. We now know that the last king of Babylon, Nabonidus, had a son named Belshazzar. Well, other discoveries have been made since then, and you know what we know now? We know now, and you can see this in any encyclopedia you want to. You can look at Babylon in the Encyclopedia Britannica and get confirmation of this. Nabonidus, the father of Belshazzar, was in retirement when Babylon fell, and Nabonidus was in Arabia. Nabonidus had left Babylon, and he'd left it under the charge of his son Belshazzar. And Belshazzar was truly the king in Babylon. And his father, Nabonidus, was in semi-retirement in Arabia. So it turns out that when the Persians conquered Babylon, the king in Babylon was in fact Belshazzar, just as Daniel had said. Now, what's interesting about this is that Belshazzar apparently didn't reign very long and was not well remembered. In fact, so little so that in the year 400 B.C., only 139 years after the fall of Babylon, the Greek historian Herodotus didn't even know about Belshazzar. He'd forgotten about him. Belshazzar had been totally forgotten to history. And even 140 years after his death, the historians didn't remember him. But Daniel did. Daniel remembered him. Daniel recorded that he was there, and Daniel told the story about how Babylon fell. Now, how could Daniel have been written after the time of Alexander the Great or after the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and known what he knew about Belshazzar being the last king in Babylon. Daniel was closer to the facts than Herodotus was, and Herodotus lived only 140 years afterwards. So I think this and many, many, many other things can be brought up, but Daniel has much in his favor, and archaeology has not given any encouragement to the critics. As a matter of fact, many of the things that they said were wrong in Daniel, they've had to kind of eat their words about. So I think Bart Ehrman, in saying that Daniel was written after the fact, is simply copying criticisms that were made against the Bible hundreds of years ago, and he's not really keeping up, with modern discovery. I think it would do him good to read something besides liberal propaganda for a change. I know he used to be an evangelical, he says. That's the thing. That's his claim to fame. That I think he went to Moody Bible Institute in Wheaton College, and he was an evangelical, and then he studied things out and became an unbeliever. Well, he didn't study them out enough. I've studied the same things he studied, and I know why. I know what things he's seen, and I've seen those arguments too. He just didn't study widely enough. Apparently, he studied from one angle, or he didn't study objectively enough. He may have been very happy to simply accept the criticisms of the Bible, as many people are, because they don't like the Bible much. They don't like what it imposes on them. They don't like what it says about them. So I'm not impressed with Bart Ehrman's honesty. Frankly, I've seen his arguments about many things, about the manuscript stuff, and he just, the things he said that he found that convinced him the Bible's not true, he should have found those things in Moody Bible Institute when he was there, because evangelicals know these things too. They just don't come to the conclusions that Ehrman reached. Now, as far as Isaiah 53 being about Israel, well, he can say that if he wants to. The Jews say that too. Isaiah 53 is a messianic prophecy, and it describes Jesus' death so graphically that it's a great challenge to unbelievers. And therefore, the Jews who don't believe in Christ and unbelievers in general, like Bart Ehrman, they often say, well, the servant there is not the Messiah. The servant is Israel. Well, I mean, again, you can say that if you want to, but the fact is that before the time of Christ, the Jews believed that that was a prophecy about the Messiah. When Jesus came and fulfilled it, and the Jews didn't want to accept Jesus, they began to deny that that prophecy is about the Messiah. That sounds convenient for those who don't want to believe, but it's not impressive of their to me, I've studied those prophecies in Isaiah about the servant. There's like four long prophecies that the scholars call servant songs, and Isaiah 53 belongs to that category. And in the servant songs, there are some of them in which the servant is Israel, but in some of them, the servant is not Israel, but the Messiah. And the progression of thought, I believe, is this, that Israel was called to be God's servant, but it says the servant was blind and dull and was rejected, and then another servant had to be called in Israel's place, and that was the Messiah. And Isaiah 53, I believe, is about the Messiah. Now, as far as Psalm 22, if he said that's about David, I'm not going to deny it. I think David did write Psalm 22 with himself in mind. But the Bible often has more layers than one of meaning. And the apostles recognize that David, in many respects, was a type of the Messiah. In fact, all the Jews recognize that. All the Jews recognize that although some things were said and done of David, that he was a foreshadowing of the Messiah, and the Messiah would be a second David. And so many of the things that David wrote about himself also apply directly to the Messiah, Psalm 22 being one of them. So those are my thoughts on those particular points. I could go over Bart Ehrman's points one by one. I guess we did that with a few of them, but we have other callers to take care of, too. I appreciate your call, Brother Frank, and you can always call with more of those later on. Let's talk to Norma from Tigard, Oregon. Norma, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yes, hi. My name is Norma, and I just have a quick question for you about the coming of the Lord in chapter 4, in Thessalonians chapter 4, I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
And it says the dead will rise first, and after that we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet with the Lord in the air. What does that mean? I just don't understand that section where it says that we're going to meet up with the Lord
in
the clouds.
Not everyone has exactly the same opinion about that, but the general opinion, and I share it with most people, most Christians, is that this is saying that when Jesus comes, that he will gather his people to himself. And Paul says the dead in Christ will rise first. So those who've died before he comes will not miss out on anything because he'll raise them from the dead. And then he says those who have not died yet, those who are alive and remain, will also be caught up with them. That is, with the dead ones that have now been raised, the living ones will be added to them and will meet the Lord in the air. Now, this is usually referred to as the rapture, although the English Bible doesn't have the word rapture in it. It comes from the Latin version of this passage because it says that we will be caught up to meet the Lord in the air. And the Greek word for caught up is translated in the Latin Bible with a word that's the root word of our word rapture. So theologians call this the rapture of the church, the catching up of the living Christians after the resurrection of the dead Christians at the coming of Christ. So the picture that it presents, apparently, it says the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout. Well, he's in heaven now at the right hand of God, so he's going to come down. It says with the voice of the archangel and the trumpet of God. Okay, so it's going to be a noisy, attention-getting thing. Jesus will come down from heaven. And it says the dead in Christ will rise first, and then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together to meet them in the air, and thus shall we ever be with the Lord. So what this seems to be saying is that when Jesus comes, all the Christians, dead and alive, will come alive and meet him in the air.
Mm-hmm. But we're still going to be, it says that both the dead and the ones that are living now, when
yes.
that time comes, so the dead are not going to, the living are not going to die, right? Is that,
that's correct.
It's just kind of confusing. So then when the dead rise again, are those going to come with the same body that we have now, or is it going to be like a spiritual body?
Well, I believe it'll be a physical body, but it'll have characteristics that our natural bodies do not have, because Paul said it'll be it's not going to be a natural body. It's going to be a supernatural body. It's going to be a body that has supernatural characteristics. According to Philippians 3, it will apparently be a body like the body that Jesus had when he rose from the dead,
mm-hmm.
which was physical. It was physical. He invited people to touch his hands and see the holes and so forth. It was a physical body. But it also had supernatural qualities, like the ability to disappear and to appear again. So apparently that's what our bodies will be like.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Steve.
Okay, Norma. Good talking to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
God bless you. Bye now. All right. You know, right now our lines are open, all of them. So if you want to get through, give me a call. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve, and you can call me at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. A listener named Thomas has been emailing me with a lengthy question. I haven't had time to answer by email, but I might just do something about this here, although our lines are now filling up. But let me quickly say, he says, long story short, I sincerely want to believe in God. The idea of having a purposeless life is repugnant, but believing something that is thus far without observable proof or manifestation is extremely difficult for me to swallow after decades of trying to do so. That said, I'm really glad that I found your website at the suggestion of a friend. You make a great deal more sense than most teacher/preachers I've heard. And while I've yet to listen to all your stuff, I would welcome any suggestions on what to listen to in this area. He goes on, I want what you speak of, he said, a personal knowing of God. But after a good deal of prayer, fasting, study, I have not attained any level of reciprocity. I want to believe God is there and have put decades of effort into seeking him move miraculously or otherwise. But always it is interesting to find that natural means supply the answers and that eventually come. This is not necessarily a bad thing if I believed miracles and answered prayers had passed away. And indeed, I often tease the wife that we are going to change churches, etc. Let me see here. So if you could direct me to something that addresses believing God in the face of zero present-day evidence in regard to answered prayers, present-day signs, following believers, that would be very helpful. Okay, only very briefly here. You say you don't want to have a purposeless life, but you have a hard time believing in something, he said, that is thus far without observable proof or manifestation. And the observable proof or manifestation you're asking for is answered prayer and or miracles. And you say that when you have prayed for things, when the answers actually do come, they come through natural means. So, in other words, even though some prayers are answered, they're not answered miraculously. In my opinion, the Bible doesn't promise miraculous answers to prayers. For example, when we're told to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread," okay, we're praying for God to supply our physical needs. I don't think he means that we're supposed to go out and look for manna on the lawn every morning. I think he means that we expect God, through his providences, to supply all our needs. Now, that providence, in many people's case, could be getting a job. I mean, if God provides you with a job, many people right now know that that sounds like a godsend, because there's a lot of people right now who would like to have jobs and can't find them. If you have a job, then God is providing your daily bread through that job. If you don't have a job and you pray and God supplies some other way, let's say some family members, give you support, or just, you know, you get a tax return or something, you might say, well, that's not an answer to prayer because that was through natural means. Well, almost every answer to prayer is through natural means. The Bible doesn't indicate that God always does miracles to answer prayer. It does suggest, however, his providences can be counted on. And that's, you know, we need to recognize what he has promised and what he has not promised. God has never promised that he's going to do miracles for everybody. And the Bible doesn't indicate that he did miracles for everybody in biblical times either. Lots of people who would have loved to have miracles didn't receive any. But the Bible doesn't indicate that that's some kind of failure on God's part to provide adequate revelation of himself. To say that believing in God, who is not has without observable proof, is hard for you to do, I just would say I think you believe in a lot of things that you don't have observable proof for. You've never seen the founding of this country or the Revolutionary War. But in all likelihood, you believe it happened. Well, why would you believe that? Well, even though you didn't see it, some people did, and they recorded it. And that's true of virtually every historic thing that's happened before you or I were born. We believe them. If we do, we believe them because we got reliable records of their occurrence by somebody who did see it. That's what the Bible provides for us. And not just the Bible. There are living Christians who have seen miracles or other things that convince them that God is real. There are people like myself who believe they have a personal relationship with God. Now, you've said you haven't had any such, confirmation given to you by God. And I was going to say I'm sorry, but I'm not going to apologize for God. God doesn't owe us anything, but we owe him our trust. Now, if that sounds like just blind faith, I don't think it's blind. The Bible says the heavens declare the glory of God, and the hosts of the heavens declare knowledge and wisdom and knowledge of God day by day. I certainly think that God has left plenty of evidence of his existence. If you were walking on the beach and you saw some words etched in the wet sand that says, "John loves Mary," well, you may not have been there to see John or Mary, present to do that, but you would know that there's a man named John and there's a girl named Mary, and that John was there and had written that. You would know that because you'd know that seagulls, just walking around didn't create that information. Seagulls might mark up the sand a little bit, but it's not going to spell words out. Where you have words spelled out, you have information. Where you have information, you know there's been an intelligent mind that left that information there deliberately. And there's tons of information in the natural world. The DNA molecule contains more information in it than the Encyclopedia Britannica. I don't think that you'd walk into a library and see the 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica and say, "I have no evidence that anyone wrote these things. I have no evidence that there's a human being that wrote these articles." Well, if you would say that, then I don't know what to think of you. But if you wouldn't say that, then I don't know why you'd say that about God either. There's in the universe, there's tons of information. And, if you don't want to look anywhere else, you could just look at the DNA molecule. That's, because that was there before we were here. Obviously, there's a lot of information in our heads, too. And we're created by God, too. But, you know, if you listen to the propaganda of people who don't believe in God, then, of course, you're going to say, well, I don't see evidence of God. But what you mean is you don't see the kind of evidence you want to demand. And you know what? God just isn't that concerned about what you and I would demand of him. He doesn't see us as being the ones in the position to make the demands. We are the losers. We are the wimps. We are the created nobodies. God is the maker of the universe. We don't make demands on him. At least I don't. If you do, have at it. But I don't make demands of God. He makes the demands. And he demands that we believe him. And he's given us tons of reasons to do so. The fulfilled prophecies of the Bible, the coming of Christ, his resurrection from the dead. As I said, the information in the DNA molecule, all that stuff. Where's that come from? How do you explain that without God in the picture? If you can think of a way, it's going to be a bigger stretch. It's going to require a bigger stretch of imagination than the explanation I have. The explanation I have is that's God's manifesting himself. If you come up with any other explanation, you're going the long way around. You're taking an explanation that requires a lot more conjecture and a lot more imagination than the obvious answer. And God, I think, expects us to go with the obvious answer. So I don't really believe that there's a person who can honestly say, a thinking person who can say, God has left no evidence of his existence. I realize, of course, that, Richard Dawkins says that all the time, and so does, Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens. These men, I don't respect for their honesty. They're not objective people. They have an axe to grind, and if they say there's no evidence, they're simply saying they're going to decide what evidence they will let God give, and he hasn't given them the evidence they want. Atheists often say that to me, if God would just appear to me right now, then I believe. Well, maybe that's why he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't let you call the shots. You see, we feel like we're the ones who call the shots, and if God, you know, wants us to be so kind as to believe in him, then he ought to accommodate us more. No one who thinks like that is probably ever going to see God. But those who humble themselves, those who deny themselves, those who take up their cross and submit themselves to God as their Lord, they'll see plenty. Anyway, let's talk to Carol from Albany, Oregon. Carol, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, that was quite a speech, Steve.
I could have gone longer, but you were waiting.
I want to talk about forgiveness again.
Okay.
I'm hoping you can tell me where in Scripture it describes the feeling you have when you have forgiven someone.
I don't think it does. I don't think there's a description of that feeling. Because I don't think that forgiveness is a feeling. If forgiveness was a feeling, it wouldn't be worth much. Because feelings come and go without any real warrant in many cases. I mean, I can wake up feeling awful, not sick, just depressed. Or I can wake up feeling energetic and optimistic. And there's nothing different about one day than the other. It's just a feeling. Feelings are important. They are organs of knowledge. Our emotions and our feelings do tell us things about the universe. For example, if I feel pain, it may be because I stepped on a thorn. I need to lift my foot up and pull the thorn out. Feelings have value, but the things that have eternal value are not feelings. Jesus said that if we don't forgive another person, then we won't be forgiven by God. So that's an eternal thing. God's not going to base eternal destinies on something as fleeting as how I feel about something. So he's not requiring me to feel anything. He's requiring me to do something. Now, forgiving is something you do. Now, I'm not saying you won't feel anything. Certainly, if you really forgive somebody, eventually I think your feelings will probably come around to agreement with it. Like if you're feeling offended by somebody and you really forgive them, you might still feel offended for a long time. But if you really forgive them, you're not going to credit that feeling as having any validity. And eventually that feeling's just going to wither up and die. It won't be there anymore because you won't give it any, you won't feed it. You see, if you forgive somebody, what it means is you make a decision. I am giving up my right to be bitter and angry and to punish that person. I don't want to punish that person. I want to love that person. I am deciding that I will release them. I am now releasing them from anything they've done to me that harms me, because I don't want to carry that around in me, and because God doesn't want me to either, so I'm releasing them from that. Now, see, if I still feel angry at them after that, I have to remind my feelings of anger that they're out of touch with reality. The reality is I forgave. You see, I don't wait to feel like I forgave and then say, okay, I guess I've forgiven now. I decide to forgive. I've heard many people say, I'm just trying to get to a place where I can forgive. No, you don't try to get to a place where you can forgive. You just forgive. That's like saying, that's like a man saying, I'm just trying to get to a place where I stop cheating on my wife. No, you just stop. You don't get to the place where you can stop. You just stop. That's a decision you make. And, you know, Jesus commands us to forgive. And therefore, by the way, Jesus could never command you to have a feeling. You can't determine your feelings. You can't call them up. You can't chase them out. You can be sad and wish you were happy, but you can't make yourself happy. You can be happy and wish you were more serious, but you can't make yourself more serious. Your feelings are not at your command, but your decisions are. So forgiveness is, it means you make a decision. I am releasing that person who hurt me from any obligation to make it up to me. I'm releasing them. I'm releasing my right to be angry at them. I'm releasing my right to punish them. I'm making that decision right now. Now, that doesn't mean I feel differently. I might, but I might not. I might not feel differently for a long time. But you see, once you've really made that decision, if you've honestly done it, then every time you have those feelings come up that are inconsistent with that decision, you discredit them. You say, this anger is inappropriate. I have forgiven that person. This bitterness is not okay because I've forgiven them. And if you just keep not feeding that emotion, it's going to shrivel up and go away eventually. You're going to eventually not have that feeling anymore. It might take a long time. But you see what we do? We nurse a grudge and we feed it until it becomes, dominant in our thinking about somebody. And, you know, then we don't feel forgiving at all. But if we are doing that nursing, it's because we have not chosen to forgive. If you really say, God wants me to forgive this person, and therefore I want to forgive this person, and therefore I do. I forgive them right now. Not tomorrow, not getting to the point where I can. Right now, I forgive them. Period. Okay, then you work on the feelings. You work on, just not affirming those feelings. We all have feelings we shouldn't affirm. You know, even unrelated to the issue of forgiveness, all people have feelings they shouldn't affirm, like the feeling of attraction to somebody else's spouse. You can't affirm that feeling. If you feel that feeling, you need to say, no, that's wrong. I can't. I will not support that. And you have to deal with many of your feelings. Anger, anxiety, hatred, fear, many feelings that come to us. We just have to say, that is not appropriate. That's not what I'm going to encourage. And eventually, your feelings will have to come alongside your decisions. But they won't if you keep feeding them.
All right. Thank you, Steve. God bless.
Carol, God bless you. Thank you for your call. I realize that lots of people, especially women, don't like that kind of teaching. I'm not saying Carol didn't like it. I'm just saying that one of the lessons at my website that people listen to a lot, the one that's most listened to, is called Refuse to be Offended. And I've heard from some husbands that their wives get so angry at me when they listen to that, because they say, you can't just refuse to be offended. Well, I do realize that women sometimes do have more struggles with their emotions than men do. I mean, I'm not saying that's not a chauvinistic statement. It's just an observation. And I realize that men, typically, they can just decide they're going to forgive someone, and then they go out and bowl with them or play golf with them and never think another thing about it. Men do that all the time. Women have more of a struggle with that. And sometimes when women hear me say, you decide to forgive, they just feel like, no, I can't do that. But what you can't do is you can't necessarily make yourself feel forgiving. But as I said, that's not what you're required to do. You're not required to make yourself feel something. You're required to obey, and that is to release any rights that you feel like you have to hold a grudge against somebody. That's what forgiving involves. Let's talk to Silas from Stanwood, Washington. Silas, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I know you only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to try and make this quick, and then I'll just let you go and I'll listen on the radio. Something that I've kind of struggled with in the past, so in the Old Testament, people like David and others, like warriors, were, you know, like, well, for instance, David was a man after God's own heart, and he was a warrior and did a lot of killing and stuff that God commanded him to do. And then in the New Testament, it seems like things changed, and, he, you know, he says, you know, you've heard it said of old, you know, hate your enemy and love, you know, love your neighbor and hate your enemy kind of thing. And he says, no, you know, pray for those that, you know, are your enemy, and like the teaching of turning the other cheek and stuff. So I've struggled with, like, okay, for instance, my brother-in-law is, I guess what you call a non-resistant, and he believes that, like, even if somebody breaks into your house and stuff, you know, that you're not to, you know, to shoot them or to take any kind of action against them. And I'm going to throw another thing in there, too. In our church, a lot of times, will, what do you call it, like, honor those that have served in the military. And I really do honor the people that do that. But I just wonder if that's okay. I just kind of wondering what the biblical viewpoint should be on serving in the military and fighting and killing and that kind of thing.
Jesus never spoke directly about the pros or cons of fighting in the military. What Jesus did say very emphatically is that we are to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. And so the question then is, how does that impact my serving in the military or not? How does that impact my resisting a criminal who breaks into my home to hurt my family or not? We are not given a list of explanations about what to do in every situation. We are told to act in love. Now, I believe that there are times when it would be the loving thing to resist an enemy. It's a loving thing because it may prevent him from doing something much worse than he's already done. And it's good for him not to do that. It's good for him not to kill people or rape people or whatever. I'm not saying kill him. I'm just saying to resist him. And after all, you do have to consider you have to love the wife and children that are, you know, given to you to protect, too. As far as going into the military, sometimes I think that might be motivated by love. I think people often have gone into the military out of love for innocent people. Like when we went into World War II, when we fought in Europe, we fought, you know, we hadn't been attacked by Europeans. We'd been attacked by Japan. But when we went to Europe, we went there partly to help our friends who were in trouble.
Right.
And so there are times when you feel out of love for your neighbor, you feel you need to intervene to help them. And some people feel that going to war is one of those interventions. I have my own struggles with the idea of war, and I have been a pacifist much of my life, but it's a nuanced subject, and I believe that some people should be honored for what they've done, even if they did something I wouldn't have done, because if they did something heroic out of love for their brethren, mm-hmm. they may be a better person than me, even if they're making decisions I wouldn't have agreed with. I would just suggest, if you want a really comprehensive answer from me on this subject, I have an article at our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com, and there's a link there that says topical articles, and among them there's one called The Believer's Use of Forcible Resistance. It talks about this in great detail, which I cannot do now because the music's telling me I've got to go for the weekend. But I don't mind talking about this another time. I just unfortunately can't do it much now, so if you want to go to the website and look at The Believer's Use of Forcible Resistance, it's an article I wrote. It's under the topical articles at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for calling. You know, The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and if you'd like to help us pay the radio bills to stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You in the Santa Cruz area? We have our monthly Santa Cruz meeting at Mike and Brenda's. There's information at the website about that. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. Tune in again Monday. We'll continue our discussion.